This is Global Torah, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service and international development. I'm Shani Rosenbaum, your host and program manager at Olam. Feeling like strangers or outsiders isn't a new experience for the Jewish people. But when it comes to serving in the developing world, navigating what makes us different as Jews, our religious or cultural practices, our identity and values, can bring with it unique challenges. What are these challenges, and what are the opportunities of living as a Jew while serving in the developing world? What values tensions emerge when we attempt to bring our daily Jewishness into a totally different cultural environment, one where complex power dynamics are at play, one where the word Jew might carry contexts or stereotypes foreign to us, or carry no context at all? Here with us to delve into these questions are Rabbi Tzvi Hirschfield of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, and Sarah Mulhern, a current rabbinical student at Hebrew College and a former staff member of American Jewish World Service. Thanks for joining us.
We're happy to be here.
Thank you for asking me.
So I want to start, Sarah, you've done a lot of leading trips for American Jewish World Service within the developing world. And one of the things that often comes up for particularly observant folks around challenges navigating their practices are particularly things related to Shabbat and to eating issues. So I'm wondering if you can just start us with, if you have some stories in mind, what are some challenges that have come up in your experience of, let's start maybe with Shabbat observance.
Great. So Shabbat, I think, can be a real opportunity in the context of a service learning program, a chance to recharge and have some more informal time with the group and with the community. But it also certainly poses challenges. I've had a number of fairly ridiculous experiences attempting to build Eruvin boundaries within which people can carry if they're observant of the laws of Shabbat of carrying in all sorts of settings where nobody understood why I was wandering around with sticks and fish wire. And there are often challenges around lights and electricity and use of resources. So one story that comes to mind that for me was particularly powerful and also evocative of some of the issues that we're dealing with today is a program that I took, that I led with rabbinical students and other Jewish graduate students in Senegal about 5 years ago, where we had a very impassioned conversation about the question of leaving on lights for Shabbat. There were members of the group who would not be comfortable turning on and off lights over the course of Shabbat and who felt that that was a real need for them to be safe and comfortable throughout those 25 hours. And there were other members of the group who felt really strongly that it was sort of an undue environmental burden and also an undue burden on the resources of this community, which had pretty rudimentary electrical grid, to come in as guests and then demand that we leave lights on for 25 hours, sort of both on a practical level, but also in terms of the message that sent made some members of the group very uncomfortable. So we had this very impassioned and I think interesting conversation about how those two different Jewish values interacted. In the end, we actually decided to leave the lights on and then the power grid went out anyways, so it wasn't really relevant. But Shabbat can definitely be challenging sometimes.
And what was your sense of what were some of the values issues you felt were coming up there that were sort of that were laid out between those different competing?
Yeah, I think on the one hand, there was a need to feel some sense of familiarity and safety, not so much in a sort of physical safety, although somewhat in terms of tripping in the dark, but a sense of like Shabbat needs to be a certain way and there need to be certain structures in place for me to feel like I'm having my Shabbat that sort of got brought up by this relatively small issue of the light switch. And then I think on the other side, there were some very strong values that I might refer to as Baal Tashchit or Hechnasat Orchim, right? The Jewish values of not wasting or of hosting and guesting in appropriate ways. In terms of what it means to come in from the outside and then, what does it mean to say like, here are my needs and I'm placing them on you. The light switch is such a small issue really, but I think it became representative of what it means to come in and articulate lines and needs, which for some people felt healthy and for other people felt uncomfortable.
I think that in general, it's interesting to note because primarily of Shabbat and Kashrut, halachically observant Jews don't travel well, right? We're the equivalent of like a dairy product taken out of the fridge. These limits make it very hard. And I guess some would argue that's the idea, right? It forces us to live in community, in very stable, consistent structures. But I think what's positive here is I think this is the whole question that we should be dealing with. What does it mean to, as a Jew who is living a committed Jewish life, what does it mean to now take that and challenge yourself to translate that into moving out of that comfort zone, out of that sort of place where you are normally at and want to contribute to something broader and larger? I think that those kind of conversations should be opportunities to really explore these tensions and these values, right? What does it mean that I want to observe my Jewish life, but I also want to step outside of my Jewish community and serve other people and connect to other people and learn about other people and be part of something broader? And I think that it's a really important question. And I think the danger is when people want to trump each other's values, right? Well, I believe God wants me to keep Shabbat. That trumps your environmental concern or your concern about not offending people. Or the other side saying, well, obviously not offending others is way more important than your idiosyncratic need not to turn on a light because it happens to be Friday night. I think we should try to avoid that and rather explore, okay, what does this mean? What are we doing now trying to be, to maintain faithful both to a Jewish identity and to something broader and more human?
And just to highlight two more things that I think you're bringing up about this story and about Shabbat in general is that the technicalities can be really hard, but I think actually the whole idea of Shabbat in the context, especially of a short-term service learning program, can be really challenging for people. What does it mean that we spent all of this money to fly to Africa for only 10 days, and you're going to tell me that for one of those 10 days, we're going to do absolutely nothing of use to the community that we came to serve? That very idea can be very challenging. And at the same time, in the context of such an intense program, actually, I think the idea of rejuvenation and renewal and rest can also be very powerful. But I've had a number of groups who the whole idea of not working on Shabbat before we get into any of the technicalities has been hard. And then the other thing I wanted to highlight about the story in terms of your piece of like not offending people is that the story as I told it and as it happened, the whole conversation sort of went down with the assumption that whatever the group decided would happen, that we would just tell the local community that that's what we needed and that they would do it for us. And that was true in the context of a setting where we were coming in as guests who were also paying to be guests in this space. But I think there's a tremendous amount to unpack there in terms of the power dynamics of the assumption that we could have this whole conversation and then we would just impose our needs on the community. Now, obviously, I hope that I sought to not impose, but actually to communicate respectfully what it was that we needed and that the people who we made those requests of heard it that way and we tried to do it in that way. But there are a lot of power dynamics at play in that piece of expressing needs as well.
I actually want to follow that line of thought a little bit because when I was sitting down to think about this topic, it strikes me that there's a long Jewish history of us being foreigners, of being sort of outsiders different than our surroundings. But most of those contexts within our history are contexts where we are a disempowered minority, where we are in environments where we're sort of embattled. And so presumably sources would reflect a sense of what do you do when you're in an environment that isn't friendly to your practice or to your culture. But the question of our privilege or our power in a context that isn't necessarily familiar with friendly to our practice or our culture may have been less discussed. I'm curious if, you know, that conversation is where our loneliness and otherness comes coupled with privilege of being Westerners, often being white, significant economic advantages. Are there tools within our tradition to address that particular constellation of challenges?
Well, I think, you know, my sense is over 2,000 years, we saw ourselves as privileged in the sense of we believed we had access to this unique covenant and this unique tradition that made us special. And gave a holiness to our lives. But in terms of the way we looked at the outside world, I think it was very much the agenda was to try to maintain a certain separateness, an otherness, to maintain our difference in the face of outside pressures. And it came at a very serious price, as you mentioned, either of oppression or limitation or a lack of security and a lack of belonging. You know, I would argue that the last 100 years have been fundamentally unique where Jews are learning to see themselves as being privileged. I don't know. We'd have to look, but at what point did Jews in America start to see themselves as white? You know, I think that my grandparents did not. I think they saw themselves as Jews and therefore saw themselves as an at-risk group among other American minorities. I think my peers see themselves as white Americans and enjoy the privilege of being white Americans. So I think that I don't think we have a real tradition of how to do this. I think we, in parallel to now having a state of Israel, which also brings with it a sense of power and choice, all those questions of what to do with our power and our privilege, I think, are now brand new to us.
Yeah, I would agree with Steve that, I mean, this question that you've asked has tremendous repercussions for our particular issue of interest today, but I actually think it's sort of the million-dollar question of modern Judaism, right? Like, what does it mean now to have the power that we have, both in the context of Israel and in the context of at least the American Jewish community? And I agree that that is in some ways a fundamentally new question. I also think that the sort of ongoing dance of creating boundaries that preserve a sense of real community and separateness that make it clear who's in and who's out in order to have a powerful sense of usness paired with a deep sense of mission for the world at large and care for all of humanity. Those two things have always been a part of Judaism, and they've always been somewhat in conflict, and they've always been valued in different kinds of balance in different times and place and by different Jewish communities. So while I think it's true this context of particular power may be a really new setting to play out that very old dance in, I think that there's a lot of wisdom already in our traditions, just even in the idea that both of those two things in and of themselves are important and that they have to be in conversation, and a lot of wisdom and experience in trying to figure out how to balance those two things. So I think it's important to highlight the newness of the question, but not in such a way as to say, and therefore the last 2,000 years of wisdom on this are not relevant. I think to say it in a way of, we have these values and thousands of years of practice in how to figure out navigating them, and now we have a really new challenge of how to navigate them in this new setting.
So can you give an example of one such challenge that maybe you experienced particularly in this context of sort of maybe a tradition that felt like it was designed to create distance or otherness, and how that came in tension with a desire also to draw connections with the communities you were?
I think this comes up in a variety of different areas. It comes up certainly around questions of what it means to interact with local religious traditions. I think often a primary motivating reason for Jewish participants to come and serve in Global South communities is a desire to learn about those communities and to experience life in those communities. And many of those communities are deeply religious. And so often, part of that is to go into religious spaces of other religious traditions and to see their rituals and see their religious spaces. And I think often a tremendous amount can be learned about communities by spending time in their religious spaces. And that can be in tension with certain Jewish practices and also Jewish instincts, that maybe it's not appropriate to be in certain kinds of religious settings, either just in general to be in non-Jewish religious settings, or specifically to be in churches with particular kinds of iconography or images of Jesus, or to be in particular kinds of religious settings, especially in the Far East, where there may be a feeling that there is worship of multiple gods, or there are sacrificial practices going on. So I think there's often a tension for participants between a desire to come from a place of learning, and therefore, of course, touring the local temple or local church would be a part of the agenda. And on the other hand, religious teachings that say, like, maybe you're forbidden to walk into that building, and maybe actually the practices that are happening there are totally condemned by various voices or the primary voice of our religious wisdom. So I think that can be complicated. I think the other area where it often comes up is around food. So one story that comes to mind is a group that I had that was particularly concerned about the prohibition of Bishul Akum, about the prohibition of not eating food exclusively cooked by a non-Jewish person, which I would characterize as being about many things, but one of them is clearly about creating distance between Jews and non-Jews. And that seems to be the goal of that rule that this group was interested in observing. And yet the way that it happened to play out, the way that we designed that it would play out on this program, was that the participants ended up spending significant time in the kitchen cooking with the local community members in this community in Muxikushka, Mexico, and actually became a real opportunity for connection between the locals and the participants. So it was an interesting example of a value that seems to be about distance playing out in a way that allowed for a real opportunity of connection.
But I would argue like that's the type of discussion that at least halachically observant Jews are not having, right? They are not looking at it saying, what does it mean to have a Jewish legal tradition that seems to consciously want to put barriers between Jews and non-Jews, whether it's food cooked by Gentiles or wine touched by Gentiles, or even many of the rabbinic texts are explicit, has to do with an avoidance of too much socializing, and want to observe those rules in a context where your whole express purpose is to engage and socialize with an outside group. And I think that discussion has to happen, and it can't just happen on the level of how can I negotiate the details of the laws, right? That's a separate thing that's pretty easily done. I think the more important discussion is what does it mean? What does it mean that I have this halachic value system that's sending me one message, and I have a, if you want to use a term, humanistic or global citizen awareness values that's sending me a different message, and how do I as a Jew want to work those things out? I think that's a more important discussion than just simply finding the technical way to meet the legal requirement. We're good at that. We have a lot of practice in technically solving those type of halachic obstacles. I'm more interested in the discussion of what does it mean to change our mindset in terms of how we look at the non-Jewish world.
Right, I agree with that. I think it's pretty easy to find a technical way to get around that rule, but what does it mean to want that, right? I think it can either be seen as this question of sort of a tension between my Jewish or halachic values and other, you know, outside humanistic or secular values that I've imbued as a modern person. But I think it gets even more complicated and more painful in cases where it feels like it's a real internal conflict. It's a conflict internal to Torah. What does it mean that on the one hand that I feel, you know, deeply convinced that God wants the Jewish people to be a light unto the nations, and that this service that we are doing on this program is an expression of my Jewish mission to better the world, which I believe God and Torah wants of me. And on the other hand, to know that it seems that God and Torah wants me to create some distance between myself and people who aren't Jewish. That, I think, is an even harder question. How do I balance those? And while acknowledging that both of them are maybe even good and holy parts of our tradition.
Where do you begin to answer those questions?
Oh, you're pointing at me now? I don't think there are answers. I think we have to reflect and think. First of all, there's a question of, I think everyone has to bring their own personal answer to that question. I mean, I think certainly in the denominationally Jewish world, people are answering those questions differently. And I also think individuals have to really have opportunities to learn and to struggle and to think about what all those things mean. I think the failure in my mind would be that Jews would do these type of projects and not struggle with those questions, which is why, you know, in my opinion, I realize this is somewhat against the grain. I think these trips are, in fact, more valuable for the insider Jews to struggle with these questions than as a way for, and forgive the term, more outsider Jews to want to engage Judaism. I think the real target audience, in my mind, would be for Jews who are heavily focused on the inside to then be challenged to think precisely about, well, wait a minute, what about the mission to the outside, and how do you struggle with that?
I think two things about that. I think first, in addition to the answers to these questions being very personal, I also think they're not the kind of questions that you answer and move on from, because I think they are actually going to play out differently based on where you are in your life, based on how long you're in the service setting for, based on the particular interpersonal dynamics in the community that you're serving. So I actually think that by their nature, really good Torah questions have to be asked in a specific time and place and have to be answered in that specific time and place, and therefore they have to be asked again and again and again. So I think there are some things that Jewish social justice organizations need to figure out as a matter of policy. AJWS, where I used to work, had a policy that we didn't eat any meat on our programs. And I think that was good not to have to renegotiate that with every group and every time. But I think some of these more deep questions actually really do need to get asked again and again and again. But I also want to respond to what you're saying about sort of target audiences and the value of that. I think there's tremendous value in people who have sort of preferenced or are just stronger, more deeply rooted in the particularistic elements of their Jewish identity and practice, having experiences where they are struggling with and experiencing and feeling the joy of being Jewish in a more universalistic way. I think that that can be a really incredible and healthy and productive experience. But I don't agree that it's necessarily more important than, I hate making this a dichotomy, but I think there's an equally important experience for those whose Jewish identities maybe as deeply felt and as important to them, but are generally expressed and understood in a more universalistic way. I think there's a huge value to those people experiencing these kinds of programs as a way of connecting the dots between that universalistic, humanistic Jewish identity that they may have and the idea of the what might feel very particularistic in terms of going with a Jewish group that maybe studies Jewish texts on these programs and has some sort of Shabbat experience. That may be the most particularist thing that some of my participants certainly have done in many, many years. And for many of those participants have articulated to me in the past that the opportunity to connect the sort of universalist stuff that they believe in so deeply with their Jewish history and their Jewish roots and with Jewish practices was really transformative for them Jewishly. So I think there's real value in both of those. The question of whether they should be the same programs or different programs, you know, we can get into that.
Am I allowed to be cynical?
Be cynical.
I'll be cynical from what's hard because you guys are so positive and yeah, it makes me feel old and crabby. But I am not convinced, I would have to be convinced that we know how to do a universalist-based identity in a Jewish world, whether that has legs, whether that's going to continue. I don't know. I mean, I guess someone could convince me or someone could say, look, it's working. But I strongly believe that if a person's only connection or strongest connections are only along that universalist path, I have real questions about whether the Judaism piece or the Jewish piece is going to strongly continue. I think we would have to strongly make the case that the particularist Jewish path is actually really influencing, not just sort of walking, you know, alongside, but really influencing that universalist value that's being expressed. Which is another way of saying we would have to really make the case that doing this work in a Jewish way is different and makes a difference to the Jewish participant in a way that Peace Corps or other things couldn't do for them. If it's just another way of doing it, that's where my cynicism says I don't think it'll last. If it's a qualitatively different way of doing it for them, because belonging to a people that has a mission, that has a history, and that has a culture, and has texts and rituals that support this and strengthen it, then I think it can go. If it's simply saying, well, Jews care about chesed, but so does everybody else, but we're a Jewish group, so we're going to talk about chesed, and the evangelical group will talk about grace, and it's all the same, I would struggle to see where that's going to continue.
Yeah, I don't think we have a disagreement here. I think
well, that's too bad.
For me, I know, what a shame. I think the whole point of what I'm saying of taking folks who have prioritized the more universalistic pieces of their what they may or may not see as their Jewish identities and trying to show them that that work can be done in a fundamentally different and more powerful way if there are particularistic Jewish elements is exactly premised on the sort of cynical assumptions that you threw out there. And I think that's the real challenge. I think there are a lot of programs, and I myself have been involved in some of them, where you basically just do the same model as the evangelical group and you just sort of go through and scratch out grace and write chesed. And like, you know, there's some sort of Jewish framing and Jewish language, which in and of itself may be valuable and like pushing people's boundaries already. But that you're right, that it's not actually like deeply getting at the question of like, how is this different because we're Jewish? And that is very, very hard and challenging work, but I think work worth doing.
What for you, is there a story or a moment that feels that it's exemplified for you in what way this work has been Jewish for you?
I think the reason I'm pausing is it's a challenging question because already we have to start to define like what would it mean for the work to be Jewish and what kinds of Jewish are we prioritizing in this conversation. I think of a moment that was very powerful for me in terms of a community that I spent some time in El Salvador called Ciudad Romero, which is a community of folks who spent the entire duration of the almost 20-year-long Salvadoran Civil War as refugees. They lived in one community and they sort of wandered for 20 years throughout that experience, and then came back together at the end of the war and built this community together, which they then named for a bit Archbishop Romero, who it was himself the Bishop of San Salvador, who was killed in the course of the war by the government for speaking out against the violence. So this sort of whole context of the power of their refugee and war experience, which I think would have been powerful to me just as a human witnessing suffering and witnessing triumph over suffering. But they were a deeply Catholic community. And one of the ways that they sort of processed and articulated their experience was through a set of murals, which portrayed that experience as parallel to or equivalent as or interwoven with maybe the narrative of the Israelites in Egypt and their Exodus story. And so for me as a Jew to be able to witness these Christians articulating their story of suffering and triumph and justice as a story that to me is a fundamental myth of my religious life, I think allowed me to sort of understand more deeply what they were articulating, and certainly the story impacted me more deeply in a different way. And so the chance to have conversations, both interreligious conversations with the community members about what Exodus means for them as Christians and as refugees versus what refugee experience and Exodus means to me as an American Jew was very powerful. But then to go back with the other Jewish participants and talk about how does it feel for us to see what we have experienced previously as our story being adapted in this way? You know, how does that create connection between us and the community members? How is that maybe uncomfortable? Like, what does it mean for me as a Jew to be connected to this story of Exodus? I think that's a conversation that was really very impactful for me in my religious understanding and would have been impossible not in the context of a group of Jews and my Jewish identity and their Jewish identity. So that floats to the surface as a way in which it was a fundamentally different experience than it could have been if I were, you know, on a pluralistic or religiously non-identified group.
This is Global Torah. I'm Shani Rosenbaum. You're listening to my conversation with Sarah Mulhern, a Hebrew College rabbinical student who has worked for American Jewish World Service, and Rabbi Tzvi Hirschfeld, a faculty member at the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies. Tzvi, if you had a vision for what it would like to present sort of a compelling model of how to do service in the Global South and the developing world Jewishly, do you think you could articulate what that vision would look like?
Could I think, what would the vision look like? I don't know enough about what it means to do service in those parts of the world to have a clear vision of it. I think in my mind, I could think what the framing would be. I think that it would include the study and grappling of Jewish texts in particular, but not only about the issues of chesed and staka. To be honest with you, most of those texts are kind of boring because they all are pro. Right, it's not, in my mind, it's not so interesting to learn the Rambam's laws of tzedaka because he's in favor of tzedaka. There's not a lot of tension there.
He's in favor of giving.
Of charitable giving. I think I would use it, I would want to see it as an opportunity to raise the question, does it matter that there is a separate Jewish people and what is their mission? And I think a trip like that should be an opportunity to ask that question, which goes back to the heart of the whole thing, right? Why do this as Jews? If everybody in the room could have found an alternative program with just nice people going to do good things in the world, and if we believe that not only Jews are obligated to do nice things in the world, but in fact all humans are obligated to be good human beings, then the question I would want to put on the table is, why should Jews be doing it? And does it matter that there is a Jewish people, and does that Jewish people have a mission? That, to me, is the question every modern Jew has to ask themselves. And I think this would be one great opportunity to get young Jewish people to ask that question in a way that hopefully they could really engage it, you know, heart, mind, and body, all right there.
And I think that is key, the sort of getting at the deep why questions and getting to those why questions through the tools of both the experience that's being had through the service and the tools of our tradition. I'm also sort of intrigued by the possibility, which I think this field has explored less, of the question of what would it be like to actually get at some of the how questions through the Jewish communities. 2,000, 3,000 years of asking some of these questions. I think there is some sort of precedent and sense of what it means to do this work and understand the work as being motivated from Jewish values or Jewish texts or Jewish history. But I think there's less a sense, although not none, of what it means to do the work in a way that is actually structurally coming from a Jewish tradition or Jewish history. So what does it mean to sort of think about, you know, reviving both a biblical and more modern history of interest-free loaning and thinking about that as a Jewish model for giving and not just a model of giving that we've taken from the secular world and put some Jewish values behind? What does it mean to think about all the many different structures that both the Bible and rabbinic tradition put out as ways for actually how to do the work and thinking about whether those are applicable or not. I think there could be some real disasters there, but there could also be some real promise and some real interesting conversations.
I'm also curious of whether we would want to not only learn about the traditions of the people that we are working with, but would we want to expose them to ours? Like, are they invited to a shacharit service, a morning service? Are they invited to a Torah reading? Are they invited to a Friday night dinner? Do we include them to say, hey, look, these are tzitzit? Or we say blessings, or some of us do, before we eat and after we eat. Let me show you what that's about. In other words, are we interested in exposing them to who we are? That would seem to be a very positive element of the interaction, where we're not only learning about their religious life or their cultural life, but they'd have a chance to learn about ours. And I think that would then put a serious and a healthy burden on Jewish participants the minute they realize that part of their job was to explain or translate some elements of Jewish life and Jewish practice for people who probably aren't exposed to that at all.
I think that is a really interesting question. I think there's a big why question to be unpacked there. Like, what is my goal in sharing my Jewish practices and Jewish identity with folks that I'm serving alongside or supporting in service in the developing world? I think there are some groups and some religious traditions for who the answer to that is clear, right? They're on an evangelical mission. They would like to convert people. That has not historically been the answer of the Jewish community. So if it's not that, like if we're not seeking to introduce people to Judaism in the hope that maybe they become Jewish, so what is it that we want them to know about Judaism and why? Is it just that we want them to see us more fully as people, and that this is a key part of who I am as a human, and if we're going to have a genuine, you know, face-to-face, deep interpersonal connection, which may be part of the point of this program, they need to know some things about my religious life. Is it that I want them to think well of Judaism, and so I want them to know that Jews are people who come and help, and who care about issues of global poverty, but I also want them to know that we have this like really cool thing where we make blessings over food? Is it just because like information is interesting? Like what is the why there behind the sharing?
I think the same way you learn and grow by exposing yourself to other people and other ideas, some of which may confirm your beliefs, some which may challenge your beliefs, I would assume that they would grow in the same way.
Right.
It's human. We grow by being exposed and challenged. Like I'm thinking, did anybody respond to them after seeing those pictures on the church of their Exodus story? Did anybody say, you know, we Jews have this holiday every year where we relive our Exodus story. Isn't that interesting? And you talk about pyramids, you know, we do something with this story also.
That exchange yields learning for everyone, and that's something that you bring as something else you offer to the community that you're serving with.
I think that leads to a richer conversation, and that's relationship.
Right. I mean, I could tell a million stories about, as a future rabbi and a religious leader, how meeting religious leaders in these communities has deeply impacted my sense of what my rabbinate is. I, in particular, think of a group of nuns that I met in El Salvador who were all from sort of upper middle class backgrounds and just moved to this town of refugees and like lived there for the rest of their lives because they felt that they needed to be in solidarity with these people, and they felt that what it meant to be demanded of them as nuns was that they needed to be in service to the poor. That was a tremendous challenge to me as a rabbi who's preparing to probably go work for like wealthy American Jews, right? Like, what does it mean for me to be confronted by religious leaders who said like, nope, I really think that Jesus would rather have me serve the poor. And like, I could be in a comfortable suburban pulpit, but instead I moved to this town and lived in tents with these people. Like, that doesn't mean that that's my future, but it was incredibly challenging and interesting and really changed my sense of how I think about my rabbinate. So I think what you're saying to me is like, why should I assume that like I have a right to grow and learn from their story, but like not do them the same respect of saying like maybe they can grow and learn from my story in some way.
In the very brief time we have left together, I want to ask one more practical question. If I am a Jewish person looking to volunteer.
I think you are a Jewish person looking to volunteer.
Might be.
Yes.
may or may not be a personal. I'm asking for a friend. what, or a whole bunch of friends who might be listening to this podcast, what resources are out there to prepare and equip me as a Jewish person looking to volunteer in the developing world? What resources are out there to help me prepare myself to deal with some of both the challenges and opportunities of what it might mean to live Jewishly during that experience?
Okay, I want to say, this isn't cynical, but I would first say, if your issues are halachic Jewish law questions, like about what I can eat, what I can't eat, how I handle Shabbat, so some of it is, I think you have to define for yourself, what are your standards, right? What are the things you can live with, things you can't live with, right? If there is somebody who can't imagine being in a mixed setting, right? They're only used to separate sex settings, separate gendered settings. This isn't going to work, right? So you got to define for yourself, first of all, what your own practice is and what your limits are, and be okay with the idea that your normal practice is not going to be available to you all the time, and be okay with that. The other thing, before I hand it over to Sarah, because I think she knows a lot more about it, I would say if you look for outside, like, rabbinic advice, please don't go to somebody who doesn't support the idea of the project, right? Don't get Jewish legal advice from somebody whose attitude is, I don't think you should put yourself in that situation. That person is not going to assist you in sort of balancing these competing values, honoring the importance of what you're doing, and seeing it as having a real claim alongside kashrut and Shabbat and everything else. So I guess my advice is, if you want to consult a rabbinic authority, speak to Sarah. Don't go somewhere where the whole project that you're on is not valued, because you won't get helpful answers.
I think the thing that I want to emphasize is that what Svi has just said about this internal process of figuring out what it is you need going into the program or the volunteer experience is really not particular to people with particular observant or halachic needs. I think whatever kind of Jewish identity or practice you're coming from, you need to figure out ahead of time which pieces of that you're okay with having shift or putting aside or maybe pausing while you're in this experience, which pieces you absolutely need to feel sort of fulfilled and healthy and Jewishly whole, which pieces you might want to see grow in the context of this program. So whatever it is that your need is, even if it is something that feels like less legal and less specific, I think to be honest with yourself about it being a need and not a want, and figuring out what that is ahead of time is just tremendously helpful. And then on beyond that, on a sort of more practical level, I would just say that I think in my experience, the most helpful thing is to always to seek out people who have been in these settings before, especially if you can find someone who's been to the particular geographic area that you'll be volunteering in, but even just in general. And there are many different Jewish service organizations who are happy to put you in touch with alumni. And I think having a real one-on-one conversation with someone who's been in this place before is always the most helpful thing.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for joining us. I've learned enormously from this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's our episode. Catch the full Global Torah series on iTunes or Stitcher, at olamtogether.org or at elmad.pardes.org. Global Torah is made possible through a partnership between the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and Olam. Special thanks, as always, to Rabbi Dr. Mish Hammer Kassoy, Diana Ginsberg, Louise Scherb, Mayan Dyer, Ben Wallach, and Seth Samuel, and of course to today's guests, Sarah Mulhern and Rabbi Zvi Hirschfeld. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. Learn more and take action at olamtogether.org.